Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
No reprise of reprisal. The president of an American-Iranian group tells us he hopes Israel's counterattack today is a sign that neither side wants all-out war.
Beyond a reasonable drought, a lake in Mexico that is rich with legends is on its way to becoming a legend itself as it begins to disappear. A local hotel owner says a shallow version of the lake is a deep loss.
The end of that sinking feeling after a years-long court battle and a political fight that's still not over. Judges in Sicily acquit the crew of a migrant rescue ship of human trafficking charges.
Resolving the unsolved. A new bill in Illinois would allow families to petition police to reopen cold cases. And the daughter of one victim tells us that offers some hope to families like hers.
It's Chrysalis Eve. Decades after the Surcease blue went extinct, scientists introduce a related butterfly to the recently revived California ecosystem where it once lived, in the hopes it can fill the same key role.
And the telltale hearts. NBC announces it will attach heart monitors to the parents of athletes during broadcasts of Olympic events in a weirdly literal attempt to prove it has its finger on the pulse. As It Happens, the Friday edition. Radio that supposes that might work if they play their cardios right. Israel struck back, but it wasn't the all-out assault many had feared. Iranian media reported that small drones were intercepted near a major airbase in the city of Isfahan this morning. And though Israel has not claimed responsibility, U.S. sources speaking with American media confirmed the attack, a response to the barrage of drones and missiles Iran fired at Israel last weekend, which was itself a response to an Israeli strike on an Iranian consular building in Damascus. Israel was under intense pressure to retaliate after the Iranian attack, but also under pressure to keep its retaliation moderate. Jamal Abdi is the president of the National Iranian American Council. We reached him in Washington, D.C.
Jamal, what you've heard and seen so far, what does it all signal to you about whether both of these countries are de-escalating the situation?
I am cautiously relieved that it seems like both sides have said their piece, have taken action that they view as conveying a message that they thought was important regarding deterrence and how they're dealing with one another, and that my hope is we can now de-escalate and, hopefully focus on getting a ceasefire in Gaza, which I think is really urgent to ensure that this doesn't continue.
What message did it send specifically, what Israel did, Israel's strike, to you and others in the community there?
Well, I think the message Israel was seeking to send was, the rules of engagement and of warfare are sort of childish and superficial. It's like a bar fight or a petty disagreement where each side has to articulate its strengths and its red lines. And in this case, that it has the last word. And I think what the Israelis did in responding, of course, the United States, other actors who have been supportive of Israel expressed that they had Israel's back. Their support was ironclad, but ruled out taking part in any offensive action. And so if Israel did want to respond to the Iranian retaliation, which of course came in response to the Israeli strike on the diplomatic compound, that Israel would need to go it alone. And so I think the message that was intended to be conveyed was that Israel wanted to signal to the Iranians that they were having the last word, that they can reach deep into Iran. Israel has the ability to escalate further. So I think it does convey that, you know, Israel has long arms and can kind of reach where it needs to reach. And so I think that was the message. But I also think what the message that was received was that, I don't want to say Israel has been chastened, but that Israel is maybe for the first time since October 7th, I think demonstrating that the United States, Europe, and others can impose some constraints on Israel's actions.
In terms of what people in Iran are feeling, what are you hearing from people you know there? Do they feel vulnerable?
I do think that there is a sense of vulnerability, but there's also, I think, a sense of frustration that this is happening. Very concerned about where this is going to go. Is this going to mean an all-out war? Those fears kind of ebb and flow, and those concerns are taking place with this backdrop of just frustration and kind of depression about the state of things inside of Iran right now, the economy and the frustration with the government and the demonstrations last year. So there's all this sort of pent up frustration and disillusionment. And then along comes this potential new crisis in the form of a war with Israel that has been looming for so many years and now seems more realistic than ever. That being said, I do think that there's a feeling of relief from those that I've talked to.
Earlier this week on the program, I spoke to a former Israeli security official, and he was saying that the strike on the diplomatic compound in Damascus was, you know, somewhere between miscalculation and deliberate provocation, you know, depending on who was at the table when. But he did worry that some Israeli officials are actively seeking to provoke Iran. So diffused for now, de-escalated for now, potentially, but where are you most worried about this conflict going next? Because it is clearly such a tense situation, and it only takes one thing to set many others in motion.
Yeah, I'm very concerned that the margin of error right now is extremely narrow. The decision by Israel to conduct that strike, I do think, was extremely reckless. And I think it is just a question of whether it was reckless out of, you know, negligence or hubris, or was it deliberately reckless? And, you know, my great fear is that it really was, the intention was to provoke Iran, whether it's to take the focus off of what is happening in Gaza, whether it is to regionalize the war and force the U.S. to enter directly to confront Iran. What is the end state that Netanyahu and the Israelis seek? If their mission is to completely eliminate Hamas in Gaza, is that achievable? Does that necessitate some greater war directly with Iran, sort of to pit Israel against the so-called axis of resistance? So I think there are very big challenges that need to be addressed. And my fear is that this was a signal that the decision makers in Israel believe that these challenges need to be addressed with a wider war. It's really incumbent on Western leaders, President Biden, others, to be able to be actors who can assert the rule of law and can assert that this needs to end with a political and a diplomatic solution, rather than taking it to a full-on regional war. And I think for now, that has been achieved, but I don't know if there is the sort of resolution or the wherewithal to do what's necessary to ensure that that is where this is headed.
Jamal, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Jamal Abdi is the president of the National Iranian American Council. We reached him in Washington, D.C. It's been 25 years since Alicia Schemmel waited for her father Donald to pick her up after work, and he never showed up. He had been shot and killed three blocks away while stopped at a rail crossing. His case remains unsolved. For decades, Ms. Schemmel and her family have longed for answers, and now they're pushing for change. Ms. Schemmel is one of the public proponents of a pair of bills making their way through the Illinois General Assembly. The legislation would grant families the ability to petition law enforcement to reopen unsolved murder cases. We reached Alicia Schemmel in Chicago.
Alicia, what do you hope these two new bills deliver?
I hope that they will solve some cases, and I hope that they will bring closure for a lot of families who have been looking for answers in their homicide cases. But most importantly, I hope that it will bring awareness to the fact that here in Illinois and across the U.S., we do a terrible job of solving homicides and gun homicides in particular. So I hope this legislation brings our homicide clearance rate to where it should be at 100%.
You wrote in an opinion piece in the Chicago Sun-Times today that the system failed you. Our listeners heard your family's story. And I wonder, though, once police had the case, how did they fail you, do you feel?
Well, they never found who did it. And when you have no answers to who committed a homicide and someone in your family, then it creates sort of like a ripple effect where you wonder if, does that person know where I live? Do they know where my kids live? Do they know where my kids go to school? So there's like a safety issue as well.
And that's on top of the grieving process.
Yes, exactly.
One of these bills would make it possible for families such as yours to ask police to reopen cases. What would that process look like? What exactly is being proposed?
So if there's been no investigatory leads for 3 years or more, the family can file a petition with law enforcement, and then they can reopen an investigation into this case. And the investigation has to be done with a fresh set of eyes. So a new detective will take a look at it and see if maybe with emerging technology or maybe with a new investigative approach that maybe the original detectives didn't have, then perhaps they could solve the case. You hear cases all the time that get solved that after a number of years. So it's definitely possible.
What do you think was missed in your father's case?
That's a tough question because I don't know. It was investigated by Chicago police and the FBI, and they never arrested anybody. They never had any suspect identified.
What do you remember about how the investigators working on your father's case, how they dealt with you and your family, what they shared, what they didn't share? Are those interactions something that inform where you're at right now and your work on this?
Yes, for sure. It does. So in the beginning, when he was first shot and killed, it was a lot of activity. I talked to a lot of detectives. And then as time went on, you stop hearing from them. So they want to meet with you a bunch in the beginning, get all this information, hear your statements over and over and over again, see where you were, where this person was, any person of interest, anyone who could have, maybe they could identify as a suspect. And then when there's not as many leads for them to go on, then it kind of switches. It goes from them calling you all the time to you calling them all the time and them not answering the phone. I was 20 when my dad was shot and killed, and I used to go to CPD headquarters and just try to find someone there who would talk to me about my case. I would just wait in the waiting room and ask, hey, could someone look at this? Sometimes I'd set up meetings and the detective wouldn't show up. They would just totally blow me off. And so we added a family liaison component to the bill to basically bridge the gap in terms of communication between law enforcement and the surviving families to maybe just give more information back and forth.
And transparency is part of what you're pushing for on a number of levels as well.
It is, yeah. So I think the general public just is not really aware that we don't solve homicides in the U.S., and I think that unless you experienced a homicide directly in your family or a friend or someone you knew specifically, I don't think you know that nobody's arrested usually in the majority of cases. So I think maybe the general public just assumes that, you know, every homicide is eventually closed and maybe they just didn't hear about it. But actually, it's the opposite.
In terms of the transparency issue, Illinois State Representative Cam Buckner has said, quote, the clearance rate metric is extremely opaque, end quote. the clearance rate, that phrasing is important as well, clearance versus closed. Why do you want more clarity on that aspect?
Oh, yeah, we want a lot of clarity on that. The homicide clearance rate is a metric used in law enforcement to be able to determine how many homicides they closed within a given period of time. The majority that are closed by this category called exceptional means. So exceptional means are, there's a whole litany of reasons why they could close a case and categorize it that way. Juveniles, suspects, extradition denied, a murder-suicide situation, suicide. And with those cases, it basically means that they're no longer going to investigate in the case. So the problem is that sometimes a cause of death and a death certificate may not be accurate. Mm-hmm. And it may be noted as a suicide when it's actually not a suicide, or there's millions of different reasons. So getting more granular into how they're closing these cases and increasing the transparency around that, I think will shed light on the actual job that they're doing.
You are marking 25 years since your father's death. It is also the 25th anniversary this weekend of the shooting at Columbine High School, where 15 people were killed, mm-hmm. including the shooters. You have come to this world of activism. Fighting gun violence is part of what you work on. How are you processing where your country is at right now in terms of gun violence and whether the U.S. will make change on that?
So first of all, it's terrible. But second of all, we have made a lot of movement in the past 10 years. The overall culture shift, I think, is starting. And because a lot of youth are now involved, and as more people vote on legislation like this one that helps keep us held accountable across the board, definitely things are changing and for the better.
Alicia, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Alicia Schemmel's father was murdered 25 years ago. She's a proponent of new legislation in Illinois that would allow families to petition police to reopen cold cases. Ms. Schemmel is in Chicago. Before the 1940s, the Xerces blue butterfly was a frequent fluttering sight around San Francisco's coastal dunes. After the 1940s, though, it was extinct. It's believed to be the first butterfly species in the United States to disappear due to human development. But now there's renewed hope for the ecosystem where it once flourished. Scientists in California have just introduced a butterfly that is a close relative, the silvery blue, to San Francisco's Presidio National Park. Darrell Capon is a senior research fellow at the California Academy of Sciences. We reached him in Mill Valley, California.
Darrell, it's been a week now since you released these butterflies. Any word on how they're doing?
The butterflies, the silvery blue butterflies, are great. We found two really cool things. The first is that we found eggs, which is extremely hard. Yeah. I looked at the growing tips of over 1,000 tiny little dune plants, which we can talk about a little later, and I found five of them. And then the adult butterflies moved about 30 meters away from one of the release sites into an out-of-the-wind area. So they're telling us what they like, and it includes the deer plants, the plants that they like in the dunes, but that also had a few oaks nearby that blocked the wind. So that was really good to learn.
This is exciting for you guys.
It's extremely exciting. This is a historic occasion. The release was making over 80 years since the Xerces blue butterfly flew in the Presidio National Park. And now, standing in Xerces' big blue shoes, as I like to say, is this species, the close relative, the silvery blue butterfly. Yeah.
They're beautiful, both of them. It must have been emotional last week as well when I saw some of the video from the Associated Press. You're all gathered. People were cheering.
Yeah, this was a major effort. Our team at the California Academy of Sciences has only been working on this project for 4 years, but the Presidio Trust and the Presidio National Park collaborators have been trying to been restoring the dune habitats that Xerxes used to thrive in for the last 30 years. So that was a big moment.
If we go back in time to when the Xerxes blue was just going extinct, before it went extinct, what role was it playing in the ecosystem?
So the Xerxes blue was playing its typical butterfly role for a gossamer-winged butterfly. They're special little blue butterflies. They have a unique relationship with ants. So it's like a little cow that was feeding ants as a larvae. And then beyond that symbiotic relationship, it was a herbivore on this plant that it likes to eat called deerweed. It was a pollinator of deerweed and other plants, and it was a prey item for lizards, birds, and even spiders, which you can imagine are a little bit of a challenge for our butterflies when we let them go. But importantly, that seems like a small role, like this is just one butterfly, but it actually is kind of an emblematic species for insect conservation. The extinction of Xerxes was an inspiration for the founder of the Xerxes Society, Dr. Robert Michael Pyle, to actually call for the sort of resurrection of a species in Xerxes' stead. So that's what we just did last Thursday. And then the second point is that insects are suffering huge declines worldwide, with some places having up to 70% of the insect biomass going missing since in the last 40 to 50 years. What that means is that all that great work that insects do, including feeding all the things we love like birds, mm-hmm. Is not being done. So the Xerxes project, releasing a butterfly in the Presidio, is like a small step in the right direction and hopefully a big inspiration for us and many other groups to try to bring insects back into our environments.
Our listeners heard in the introduction to our conversation that their habitat disappeared because of human development. What was in their habitat? What and how did humans destroy it?
So the western half of San Francisco, four colonists came, was basically a large sand dune from Fort Funston, the cliffs in the south of the city, all the way to almost the Golden Gate Bridge where the Presidio is now. Those areas were transformed into the familiar neighborhoods that we know and love, the Outer Sunset, Golden Gate Park, the Richmond District, and the Presidio.
What does the Presidio look like right now, for those who haven't seen it?
So we have Presidio Dunes area, right where we release the butterfly, as little mounds of dune sand with small plants growing on them, including this deerweed. And if you take a broader view, there are native plants planted nearby, these oaks and other woodland species. And then you look out a little farther, there are native Monterey pine and cypress, which probably weren't there before settlers, but would have been something like a beautiful redwood tree. And then there are amazing vistas, obviously, of Golden Gate Bridge and out to the ocean to the south.
It sounds like a very pretty picture. And add the butterflies to that.
Yeah, add the blue butterflies and use them as a lens to think about how we can regenerate the Presidio and other areas even more. Like, we can add more than dunes. We can add more species from dunes. We can add new trees. Who knows? It's just the beginning.
Yeah, it's exciting. But as you look, you know, things are going well now. You told us off the top of the things you've seen that show you they're adapting well. What are you watching for, though, and doing to make sure that things continue going well?
So this is really only the first step. And so I've guessed, and our team is ready to work on this for years to come. So the first step we're going to do is to monitor egg and larval survival. But with so many plants and so few eggs that you can see, I'm finding that exciting and difficult. So I sit on I kneel down and look with these, like, literally 18 inch away with a pair of binoculars, mm-hmm. to see if I can see that egg every day and see when it hatches. And that's going to be really exciting when we find that. And then hopefully by next spring, we'll see silvery blue butterflies emerging from their chrysalis and flying around again approximately the same time of year.
Darrell, thank you.
Okay, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Darrell Capon is a senior research fellow at the California Academy of Sciences. We reached him in Mill Valley, California. So I just put these electrodes here and here, like that. And oh, that's my heartbeat? That's cool. It seems a little slow maybe, but our studio is in a subterranean cave where the temperature is always hovering around freezing, so I'm probably just hypothermic. Anyway, you want me to read this tongue-twisting copy? No problem. February's brewery statistics come with an ignominious asterisk. For the sixth time, one rural brewery on an isthmus in Worcestershire is requesting No, I'm not doing this anymore. How do I get these things off? Get them off me. What a fun experiment. Frank, it was a little uncomfortable for me as the subject. Sorry, my heart. But I'm sure I'll get used to it if CBC management decides to attach heart monitors to radio hosts. This idea didn't just come out of nowhere, though. NBC has just announced a huge slew of attention-getting Olympic gimmicks for this summer's games. Kelly Clarkson will interview athletes. Snoop Dogg will, have the higher part of faster, higher, stronger down when he reports from the streets of Paris. And Jimmy Fallon will be there. But NBC has also announced that during some events, it will attach heart monitors to the parents of the athletes who are competing. You will hear the parents' heartbeats accelerate while their kids do the same thing. You'll hear their hearts pound with elation if their kid wins and thud with disappointment if their kid loses. Apparently, this has been very popular with test audiences. It just sounds stressful to me, but you should just follow your heart if you want to follow other people's hearts. And maybe it isn't that intrusive, really. I already just put my electrodes back on, so, you know, let's just turn the monitor back on anytime, you guys. It's... What? It is on. But I don't hear my... Uh-oh.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Normally, a visit to Pátzcuaro Lake in Michoacán, Mexico, includes a boat ride to one of its islands, especially during Day of the Dead celebrations. The area is famous in Mexico for its cemeteries, where families gather at tombs covered with marigolds and candles. But recently, you could get out there without a boat. You could just walk across the lake. It's bone dry. Pátzcuaro officials say that since they started tracking its falling water levels, the lake has lost half its volume. Arturo Pimentel is the president of the Hotel Association in Pátzcuaro. That's where we reached him.
Arturo, I know you're near the lake right now. When you go out to the shore, what do you see?
Well, it's usually we have a view of the lake, you know, this big circle of water with some islands inside. And right now, the main island, which name is Janitzio, you can, there's about like 10 meters in between the island and this new land spot. So it is very upsetting for the people in the whole area. And it is just part of this disgrace that is growing since a few years ago when all pine trees are being just cut off to grow avocado trees. It is the avocado has become like a plague in the area.
I understand authorities have also found some people from different farms are stealing water from the lake. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah, it's true. This is happening since years ago. But now we are aware of this because it's really affecting the lake right now. There are pipes, there are pumps feeding out water for the, you know, the, all type of farms, cows, pigs, you know, whatever they grow on the farms. And for the all corn and other cereal fields in the area. So this discontrolled consume of the water is now giving us really hard problems because we are very concerned about the extinction of this lake in a couple of years.
Our listeners heard in the introduction to our conversation that this lake is certainly popular around Day of the Dead celebrations. But just beyond even the Day of the Dead, what does this lake mean to the community there?
Well, yeah, this lake is the cradle of a very important culture in this area. And besides that, this is, you know, all the fauna and all species that we're missing that used to live in the lake, that were, you know, this belongs only to this place of the of the earth. So it is very very important because this have not only a cultural importance, but also tourist and economical, and all this nature matter that is going on around, and is very concerned. This is not the only lake endangered in Mexico, but culturally, I think it's the most important in Mexico, because the values, I say, traditions, and someday this will be a legend as well, very sadly.
I've seen some videos of how beautiful it is during those Day of the Dead celebrations. Can you describe what it is like on the islands in the lake on Day of the Dead?
Well, that celebration, the Day of the Dead, it's like a local Christmas Eve. The people used to go to cemeteries to share with those that are not in this dimension again. So it is very important because there are so many flowers around, and people used to go to cemeteries by night. I think that the most important reference we have world known is the film Coco, where you can see how it is. It is true what they tell in the film. All this atmosphere and we have visitors from all over the world, and it's the most important thing that happens in this area. So the lake is very important because it's also the fountain of so many stories, so many legends, history. Yeah. It's a fountain of life, and we're losing that part of this area.
I can tell, Arturo, that you care about the history and the natural resource that is there. I wonder how it's affecting you as a business person.
Well, right now, the Pátzcuaro Lake is in the middle of this storm of media information. So it is very important to call attention for it, because we need the governments and the citizen to pay attention to it. Especially right now in this area, as in the country, we are in elections time. So everybody's in campaign, and they're talking about the issue and lots of blah, 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 but no action yet. So we need that the people that are in charge now get to work.
Has the government done anything to try to protect the lake right now, though?
Well, right now they have guards, they have police around the lake to take care of those that are still in water. But the federal government doesn't manifest yet. And I read on the newspaper yesterday that they will plant clouds, you know, to provoke this artificial rain. hoping to help the weather in the area.
When you think ahead to the Day of the Dead coming up in November, it's certainly your busy season as a hotel owner. I know you've imagined worst case scenarios, but do you imagine a best case scenario for November? What do you hope the lake will look like then?
Well, we have people as usual, I guess, because always we have these full hotels and all these tourism matters. But hopefully there will be through the rainy season and some other things. Some other things people are doing. Maybe we have a fair recovery of the lake. But as well, we have to think as business people here that we have to develop some different tourism attractions and to have other options for those people who want to see this. And anyhow, right now, this matter is calling the attention of everybody. So maybe we have another type of people coming to see this disgrace.
Arturo, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Arturo Pimentel is the president of the Hotel Association in Pátzcuaro, Mexico. That's where we reached him. Church bells ringing out in Saint-Georges, Quebec today before the funeral for Jacob Flickinger. Mr. Flickinger was one of the seven World Central Kitchen workers killed when a series of Israeli airstrikes targeted the charity's convoy in Gaza on April 1st. Mike Luzat wasn't related to Jacob, but describes him as more than a brother. He spoke with reporters today outside the church where his friend was baptized.
I met Jacob back in 2010 during the Afghanistan mission training. At that moment, we were colleagues. We both knew who we were, respecting each other, but our relationship became strong after the army in 2015, where I started my business as a survival instructor, and Jacob offered his help. And from there, we began to develop a relationship of brotherhood, a strong brotherhood.
How would you describe Jacob as a person?
How can I describe Jacob as a person? He was a strong-minded person, disciplined. He never had any excuse. So he was probably the strongest person I ever met in my life. I feel empty. I feel alone. Even though I have friends and family, a part of me is gone now. But it's my duty to keep sharing the lessons that Jacob taught me. If I have this privilege, I want to develop a strong relationship with Jasper, his son. I would love to teach everything Jacob taught me to his son. So this way, he will know how powerful and strong his father was. So he was an adventurer. He needed to expose himself. So this was just another adventure in his post-army life. He had to do something. He could not remain at the same place for a long time. So as a Viking, he went on his last raid, and his death happened, and now he deserves his place in Valhalla.
Mike Luzat speaking with reporters outside the funeral for World Central Kitchen volunteer Jacob Flickinger today. Mr. Flickinger was killed by an Israeli airstrike in Gaza on April 1st. Sasha Gierka says what happened today was an uplifting symbol, although for him and for his fellow crew members, that's kind of an understatement. In August of 2017, Italian authorities seized the Juventa, a ship that had rescued thousands of people in the Mediterranean Sea. The rescuers were accused of aiding and abetting unauthorized immigration, and in some cases of collaborating with human smugglers. Four members of the crew faced the possibility of enormous fines and 20 years in prison. But today, 7 years after their legal nightmare began, judges in Sicily acquitted all crew members. And we reached Sasha Gierka in Trapani, Italy.
Sasha, acquitted after 7 years of waiting. How did you react in court?
I'm really welcoming the decision, and I'm relieved, I really have to say, after this 7 years. I was, to be honest, I was concerned about our press release being ready and that we catched all the important moments. So I was, I keep myself busy, let's say, to not be so overwhelmed. But it's super nice because I'm surrounded with a lot of friends and a lot of comrades supporting us over the years, and they all came to Trapani. We were like 30 people. They were waiting outside the courtroom, and when we came out, there was cheering us, and there were like banners and speeches, and that was really, it was a really great moment after all these troubled years.
And just to remind our listeners, the ship was seized 7 years ago. The official charges came 3 years ago. But ultimately, why do you think it took so long for this case to wind its way through the judicial system there and to finally get a verdict now today? Why did it take so long?
Yeah, why did it take so long? Because the trial it was on purpose. It was a politically motivated trial. And it was dragged on for so many years because it was used by the right wing. It was used by the investigating authorities. It was used by politicians of all colors.
You and your colleagues were accused of collaborating with human smugglers.
Yes, there were. And you know, there were like fast resources were mobilized. There was an anti-mafia prosecutors. There were special police units. And they were like deployed against sea rescuers, right? And since 2016, so since the seizure and the investigation started, this entire operation has been used to legitimize the increasing crackdown on sea rescue efforts. And for this, the case of the Juventa was always used as an argument. But today, the judge made really clear that none of our interventions were... they were crime, not they were not only our duty, they were our right. We had a right to rescue, and that was established today in court, and that's what really relieved me.
So, you know, you used the word relief earlier, but you've also said, on the other hand, you don't think that this should have ever happened, the trial should have ever happened.
Yes, because you know, these profound concerns we have to express. It's over the damages already caused by the investigation and the trial, right? And it's the result of this sloppy investigation driven by political moments was that thousands of people have died in the Mediterranean or have been forcibly returned to the war-torn Libya. And if the Juventa had not been seized, the ship could have made an important contribution to their rescue. But instead, our ship was left to wreck. And we were dragged into this trial, what was, lasted for years.
What have you been doing over these past several years?
So on the one hand, we were not intimidated by this trial. So a lot of the crew were deployed on other vessels. So we joined other rescue crews like Sea Watch, Luis Michel, Mediterranea. So all the ones who are still active. On the other hand, the trial was like, eating up so many resources, not talking about money only. For me, for example, it was a full-time job.
The Juventa performed about 40 missions before it was seized. Our listeners may remember some 14,000 people were rescued, according to your numbers. Do you have any sense or connection with any of those people that you were able to save?
It's very different. For example, one guy, Abdul Rahman, he's now in Germany. He studied. He made his way. He became a father some weeks ago, and he is really welcomed by a local community of people. So he really arrived in a safe place, and he could make a new life. Others, their asylum requests were rejected, so they had to find, they were forced into a living of in illegality, right?
How would you assess, Sasha, where things are at for migrants on the Mediterranean at this point in 2024?
To be honest, it's getting worse and worse. And that's really hard to say because from 2016, when we started our missions, then we witnessed this increasing denunciation and the blocking of the ship started, and we thought, okay, but this is really the end. It cannot go more worse. But now I have to admit it's really more worse. And the key point is the so-called Libyan Coast Guard. So these ex-militias financed by the European Union and equipped with a lot of vessels and all the means necessary to intercept people on the sea and bring them back to Libya. And that's something what increased in the recent years. So since the seizure of the Inventor, more than 200,000 people were forcibly returned to Libya.
Given the picture you've painted, I wonder if you can celebrate for yourself and your colleagues today.
I would not call it celebration, to be honest. No, that would not be the right word. It's a relief because now we can look the resources we still have and the lifetime what is in front of us. We can use it better than defending ourselves in a baseless trial. So we will be back in mission with the Inventorship as soon as possible. And in the meantime, we will go with other rescue NGOs and contributing to the rescue of people.
Sasha, thank you.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sasha Gierke is one of the acquitted crew members from the rescue ship, the Juventa. We reached him in Trapani, Italy. Christopher Nipash and Rory Henry Felstead seem to have the science bug. They're students at Luke Medawescom School in the Cree community of Nemaska in northern Quebec. And last year, they came second in the Quebec Indigenous Science Fair. But last month, at this year's fair in Gatineau, Quebec, Christopher and Rory did themselves one better. Their project this time around was an investigation into the counterintuitive idea that the trees inside the boreal forest might have firefighting and fire-surviving powers that we could learn from. But maybe I should let Christopher explain.
Basically, how we got the idea from this project. For this project, I guess, was the forest fires last year, and we wanted to find out a more natural, non-toxic way and how to stop it with the plants. With the fire adaptive plants that we picked out.
Rory, tell us about the results from your research. What did you learn from conducting your experiments?
Well, we found out some interesting stuff. The majority of the plants didn't really work as well as fire retardants compared to the commercial one that we used, which was ammonium sulfate. But the one that we did find that argued compared to as well and could be just as good, and it's less toxic, so we think it could be better, was jack pine, and it consistently compared to all of them took the longest to actually physically catch on fire. Once it was on fire, it performed about the same, but it took probably a bit like a few seconds longer to actually catch on fire.
So what was it like to hear your names called for the grand prize? Were you surprised at all? Were you like, how are you feeling?
It was good. I didn't really hear anything until they had called out, our last names. So I kind of, stood up and tapped Chris on the shoulder and, kind of told me, hey, we won, let's go up. And we went up, and then they awarded us, took our hands, and then we just kind of went off. But it was fun, and it was exciting.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Chris, how are you feeling about it when you heard your name get called up?
I don't really hear them call our name out until I saw it on the screen. And like Rory told me that we won. And I was just like, what? I was just like, it just like took me off guard. And I was just like, I couldn't believe it as I was walking up to stage. But like, as I got up, I was just like, I won. And this is mine. I just like went to go accept it.
Christopher Nipash and Rory Henry Felstead are students at Luke Medawescombe School in the Cree community of Nemaska in northern Quebec. They are the winners of the 2024 Quebec Indigenous Science Fair. They were talking to the CBC's Allison Brunette. The scam is simple, but it's terrifying. Your phone rings, someone pretending to be a law enforcement officer is on the other end. They tell you your child or grandchild is in police custody. In some cases, they may even pretend to be your child in distress. And whatever the specifics, one thing is for sure, bail money is needed, fast. Now, police in Ontario and Quebec have arrested 14 suspects in connection with what they're calling grandparent scams. They say that over the last few years, this particular group of fraudsters has stolen more than $2.2 million from Canadians. Sean Chatland is a detective inspector with the Ontario Provincial Police. We reached him in Barrie, Ontario.
Detective Inspector, what can you tell us about these 14 people?
Yeah, I can tell you that as a result of this very lengthy investigation, we were able to identify some trends and were able to ultimately identify the 14 individuals that have been arrested and were charged over the last 2 weeks in Montreal. And I would describe them as a very well-organized group. They were able to reach victims right across the entire country. They worked in a very sophisticated manner. It took us some time to be able to identify this group and figure out who was responsible for what, how they were operating, how they were contacting victims, and even just to identify the commonalities there. Mm-hmm. So a very sophisticated crime group. And fairly young in terms of ages, I would say all under the age of 40.
You were collaborating with Sûreté du Québec on this. They have said that there may be ties between this particular group and, quote, traditional Italian organized crime. How so?
Well, what I can tell you is again, this group was incredibly sophisticated with how they were operating. And again, it took some real time for us to be able to figure, the inner workings of this network out, to be able to iron out who was responsible for what tasks, how are they contacting victims, mm-hmm. and to be able to really identify the commonalities amongst the victims themselves. It was some time in before we realized that they were focusing, for the most part, strictly with victims on that had landlines. And that, I think, goes part and part with this, how this fraud was facilitated.
Beyond that aspect, the landline aspect, can you tell us a little bit, just generally speaking, about the victims here? Who are they?
I could tell you that it doesn't seem to matter where I go in the province. I am told constantly by colleagues, by even my own family members, by friends, by other officers, how they know somebody that's been defrauded. They know somebody that this has happened to. And in this particular case, they're preying on victims who, in many cases were elderly, in some cases had cognitive issues, some significant damage done, life-altering for many, many of these victims. And it's very difficult with fraud because we feel that it's only 5 to 10% of it is reported. And so likely the losses in this case, sadly, are much bigger than we even think.
Our listeners heard that this group has allegedly stolen more than $2 million from Canadians since February 2022. Is there any chance the victims are going to see any of that money again?
Well, I mean, we do have some victim programs available here in Ontario, and I mean, hopefully we'll be able to get some of that money back. It's going to be very challenging in this particular case, but what I'm extremely proud of is that the investigative team was able to disrupt another almost $500,000 that was going to be victimized. So based on the information that we received, we were able to reach out to the financial institutions other family members, and we're able to disrupt the fraud that was going on. And so I'm really proud of those efforts. It's not something we're always able to do, but in this particular case, it was extremely, extremely successful.
So they were about to call these folks and put on this scenario? You knew they had their numbers?
Well, we knew in some cases, one of the things that really happened in this case was that they reached out to these victims on multiple times. And I hadn't anticipated that, but several of these victims were re-victimized, and they were spoken to several times over even sometimes weeks. And so that allowed us the opportunity to disrupt some of it.
Detective Inspector, I have to ask, because I know people at home are wondering, even if this hasn't happened to anyone that they know and love, what should people do? Because I really think anyone in just the wrong moment could easily get caught up in this. So what is your advice to people to try to protect themselves and others?
Well, I will absolutely tell you that anybody can become a victim of these kinds of offenses. And what I will say is it can be, as I said, life-altering. And so don't blame yourself. They're very challenging investigations to work through. But please report it to your local police if it does happen. But from the forefront, if you don't know the phone number that's calling you, then you know perhaps you don't even answer it. Let them leave a message. And if you do end up in a conversation with these people, then please take a second, and you just these days seemingly have to question whatever information is before you. So reach out to that family member, confirm that that everything is either okay or not okay, and before any further steps are taken. Professionals in the justice system will never reach out to you demanding money. They will never show up at your house demanding money. Certainly there are mechanisms in place for people that are in custody and need bail posted for them, but that is not ever done at showing up at your house demanding cash. So please be aware of that, and the biggest piece of this, I think, is doing what we're doing right now and getting the information out there and trying to touch as many people as we possibly can with this so that they're better armed.
Detective Inspector, thank you for your time.
Thank you for getting this information out there.
Sean Chatland is a detective inspector with the Ontario Provincial Police. He's in Barrie, Ontario. Don't fall, eat well. Good advice for anyone to consider. But in the year plus since a friend shouted those words at Florence Ryan, she's considered them again and again. She's a cyclist who is currently about 30 kilometers away from Cape Town, South Africa. But in the clip you just heard, she was in Cairo, which is about 13,000 kilometers from Cape Town, as the Florence bikes. It has taken her 16 months to pedal through Egypt, Sudan, Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania, Malawi, Zambia, Namibia, Botswana, and now South Africa. We reached Florence Ryan, who goes by Flo, on the very last night of her journey in Melkbosstrand, South Africa.
Flo, when you hear that clip that our listeners heard just a moment ago, what memories does it bring to your mind? Where does it take you?
Wow, oh, that's crazy. I haven't seen that in a long time. It brings back a lot of memories. It was my departure from Egypt, basically. And I only saw that when they sent me the video later on.
Yeah. You did get into trouble pretty quickly, so we're going to play our listeners a short clip from one of the first vlogs you put out.
This is the pyramid of Maidun, and we are currently in a police car because we're being escorted to find Rob's selfie stick in the sand. And I'm currently in the car with all of our bikes. This, I cannot make this up. You guys, I could not make this up. This is only day two of our Cairo to Cape Town cycling trip. It's only day two, man.
Yeah, a flat tire perhaps would not have surprised me, but this did. You had a lot, though, of encounters, Flo, with police in Egypt. Why?
It's very important that Egypt has a good reputation in international media, et cetera, because otherwise tourism could go down, and that would really badly impact the revenue of the country. So they want to make sure that all the tourists are safe and everything's going well. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of why we had police following us. Like, they basically just wanted to make sure that we don't cycle, that we don't go to places that we shouldn't, quote unquote, shouldn't go because they're quote unquote unsafe. Mm-hmm. But it was totally ridiculous.
Yeah. You did have company. You were with your friend Rob, and there were other riders mm-hmm. who joined you in and out throughout the trip. Were there any points along the way where you were questioning why you were doing this, that you felt unsafe, maybe?
Questioning why I was doing this every day. Like, every day you face challenges, whether it's the wind or the rain or crazy hills. Like, it's physically very demanding. So every day I question what I'm doing. But safety-wise, to be honest, no. That's one of the main lessons that I'm taking away from this whole journey, is that people always say, like, Africa is very unsafe. All you see in the media is this war, poverty, crime, etc. But honestly, I feel way safer cycling across Africa than I would walking alone at night in London or Paris. So I think that the least safe moments, I mean, we've had a few incidents for sure with like bandits and rebels and stuff like that. But the most I felt unsafe is usually on big highways, like trucks and buses passing.
Yeah. You said that many of the most memorable encounters you had were in Sudan. We want to play another clip from a video you posted during your time in Sudan. So what was happening on that day of the ride?
We basically had woken up in the middle of the Sahara Desert, and we started cycling across the desert, and then saw a tiny village. So we cycled into this village, and a group of men stopped us on the side of the road, like forced stopped us and said, you have to stop, you have to come and drink tea with us. And they were actually hosting us in their home. So they invited us into their garden, they fed us, they gave us tea. They were so wonderful and so hospitable. And one of the gentlemen that was there sang, and he was playing the oud, which is a traditional instrument. And it was a wonderful example of Sudanese hospitality and them showing us their culture.
You left Sudan a week before the war broke out there. When you see what's happening in the country now and remember that hospitality and the kindness that you saw there, how do you weigh all of that in your mind?
Honestly, it's very devastating, especially because now, yeah, it's been a year. We left Sudan on the 6th of April of 2023, and the war broke out on the 15th of April, just a week later. A lot of our friends and people that we met during our journey that showed us such hospitality, including this family that was in the video, have either fled entirely, they've managed to escape and go to other neighboring countries, or they have relocated to other parts of the country because their homes have been completely destroyed. And it's really sad to see, honestly, because it just shows the disparity between the people and the governments. Like, the people of Sudan are incredibly kind and generous and peaceful, and unfortunately, they're suffering because of the disparity with the government.
When you made this decision to take this trip, why did you want to do this?
For many reasons. First of all, I love adventure. I love exploring. I love traveling and learning about the world. And I'm in my mid-20s, and I thought, if I don't do this now, I will never do this probably. So I have the time to take a go on a journey like this. But it's not just a journey of exploration and travel. It's also self-exploration. You know, it's a physical feat. It's a physical challenge. It's a human-powered journey. So it's just me and my legs cycling. And it's very, yeah, very fulfilling and rewarding. But there's not just that. There's also the stories part. And Africa in the media and the way that we know it in the West is so negative. It's always, you know, they talk about wars, they talk about poverty, they talk about problems, but it's very, very rich in culture, in history, in stories of people. It's extremely diverse. And that's one of the aspects that I really want to show and to document this and to show this basically side of Africa.
Are you ready for the trip to end?
I'm not sure. But I also think in life, we're not always ready to move on to a different phase of life or to start a new job or to go to university. Like all these different important phases in life, you're not always ready to do it, but you do it anyway. So I don't think I'm ready, but that's okay.
Flo, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Florence Ryan is a cyclist who completed a 13,000-kilometer journey from Cairo to Cape Town, and will complete it tomorrow. We reached her in Melkbosstrand, South Africa. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.